Support for Soundwaves from the Underground is brought to you by 24tix.com, the most convenient way to buy tickets to your favorite local concerts. Save time, save money, rock out. 24tix.com, your ticket to the experience.
I like the idea that I had to give that legal disclaimer. I mean, you just have to. We live in a litigious society, Ricky.
Yeah, definitely.
It's not going to make it, it's not going to go away.
Probably cut that out, Gavin, because I don't know what we're doing.
I'm JP, and this is Soundwaves from the Underground, the official podcast of Slug Magazine in Salt Lake City, Utah. Slug is an acronym for Salt Lake Underground, and we're one of the oldest independent publications in the U.S. We distribute free monthly issues about music, art, action sports, and subculture. On today's episode, we're going to find out about the design programs at BEAU, which is Broadview Entertainment Arts University. We'll be speaking with local artist Audrey Newhouse, and we'll be profiling the incredibly strange movie night. Broadview Entertainment Arts University, or BEAU, is a Salt Lake college focusing exclusively on the entertainment arts. They specialize in digital video and media production, game art, comic and sequential art, graphic design, music production and engineering, sound design, as well as visual media. Randall Schmuck is a program chair and professor with BEAU, specializing in entertainment design. He's also had 2 decades of experience under his belt as a designer and art director in the motion picture industry. Thank you for joining us, Randall.
It's my pleasure.
You started out with a Master of Architecture degree, if I'm not mistaken. Can you tell us how you went from designing buildings and structures to designing sets?
Yeah, it was quick and easy. By the time I graduated from college at the University of Washington, I knew I wasn't going to go into the practice of designing buildings. And so it was just a little bit of a lag there before I teamed up with an old buddy, and he was building little buildings for television commercials. And I said, I'm going to get involved in that.
So it was pretty seamless.
Didn't seem like it at the time, but when I look back at it, it is.
Yeah, some people have a high barrier for entry. They have to look around forever, maybe if they ever get to break into the industry. And what kind of projects and who have you worked for over the years?
Well, there were commercials. So I was involved in about 1,000 commercials on the national level, including things like for McDonald's, Christmas commercials, where we did fake snow in the middle of July. But on the motion picture side, I worked with some of the big studios. I was lucky enough to work with some of the top designers, Patrizia von Brandenstein and John Meyer. Both are Academy Award winners, not that I was, but working with them is like exceptional. And I got to work with Bobby Moresco on 3 different projects, and Bobby Moresco was the Academy Award winning co-writer for Crash, and he was co-producer on
Million Dollar Baby. But that was kind of like a master class working with all these people. You picked up the industry ins and outs, as it were.
Yeah, I think it's fair to say the more one works in the industry, and if one is paying attention, it's real easy to start to see this is the way to do some things, this is to be avoided. And if one is lucky to be around people who actually invite that kind of innovative thinking. I've been real fortunate that way. Most of the people I've worked with have been very inviting and accepting, supportive of innovation.
Does that carry over to your work here at BEAU or Broadview?
Sure it does. With the local group, for sure. Because we're starting up a new school, and that takes just a tremendous amount of effort, that the people that are involved locally are flexible but creative, and we're constantly trying to mold, refashion the school as we realize it needs to go this direction, it needs to incorporate this or that. So I find that to be one of the most rewarding aspects of the work.
Dan Krogerman approached you, he was a founder of Broadview, and how did he pitch the idea of working at a school versus continuing on in the industry in more of the fashion you were?
Well, the interesting thing is Dane and I have known each other for a long time, and we've worked together before in television commercials. So it was easy. He just came up to me and he said, how would you like to do this project? This is what I'm involved in. You want to be involved too. We've talked about education and the importance of it, how it might look if we had the chance to dabble in it or be instrumental in forming it. And so it was a no-brainer when he first approached me. But that was 2004. And it took till 2010 before he said, we're doing it, it's going forward.
Can you briefly describe some of the specialties that brought you to Broadview? And as chair of the entertainment design program there, what is your role and what is the goal of that program?
Right, entertainment design, most people go like, what is that? They don't quite understand what entertainment design is. It's a very descriptive term, but it's probably mislabeled. We should just call it stage and screen. People would maybe understand what it is. What it is, on a motion picture, designers are involved with the entire three-dimensional aspect of designing for that story being told in a movie or in a play at a theater, or if it's that sort of immediate short-term story that's part of stage performance in a live performance. So it's all three-dimensional environment design.
What were some of the things that grew on you from the architecture side that then transformed into more of the set design? What are you passionate about in that regard?
Well, early on, and I haven't been able to bring this completely to fruition into a motion picture, but early on in my architectural training, I was exposed to some architects that did very free-form, curvilinear kinds of architecture, Antonio Gaudí in Spain, and they encouraged me to use that vernacular in my schoolwork. And trying to do that, I think opened up just a whole other world, thinking about the way things could happen. It didn't have to be square walls. And one of my instructors said, do it now because you won't be able to do it later. They won't let you do that later. And it's very few people that have been able to accomplish that, Frank Gehry being one of them, and only because he patented the industrial aspect of curving the steel. And so now he wants to use it everywhere. I mean, he owns the process. But so though I haven't been able to incorporate that particular flavor of visual imagery, I still have been able to think differently about things. And so the first thing that comes to me isn't, well, we'll do a square room here with another square room over here. It's more like, how can that possibly happen in a space that makes sense? I think the best place that came to some sort of expression was when I worked on the first X-Men. I was the art director in charge of design in Los Angeles. So we did some very different looking sets for that particular movie, and it was partly because people were receptive to the whole thing, the Marvel people behind all of it, but also just the way of thinking about things allowed for that to happen.
I've been curious ever since, and I'm glad you brought up X-Men, because there's the building itself, which houses the school, and then there is the interior, Xavier's mansion, as it were. Was that a soundstage? Was that all built, or was that shot on location?
It's half and half. So there's a couple of rooms in the school that are built, but the building itself exists in Toronto. And so it was shot, aspects of the interior shot, and typically what happens in motion pictures is you turn a corner, go into a door, and then the camera steps inside the room and we see the door open. Once the camera's inside the room, you're on a stage set. So we did that on a number of things. Also, the grounds were in a completely different location. So we had hallways, the yard or grounds, and interiors to specific rooms that were all three different places.
Well, congratulations. The work on that, your work specifically, was really nice. Still one of my favorite X-Men movies was the first one, of course. Bang-up job, as they say. And you have the type of real world work experience that must transfer really well to the classroom. And I'm sure you use anecdotes and types of real scenarios that happen to explain things to your students. That must give you great advantage in your ability to teach.
I'd like to think so. The anecdotes transfer very well. Sometimes the ability to tell the student, here, you need to go and look at it over here, and that there's a deadline, and that those things are real, and they shouldn't expect that wouldn't happen just because we're in school. Those things don't transfer as well. But that's part of the learning experience. And so I try to throw them into the deep end of the pool immediately and just don't let anybody drown. Then take them back out and go like, okay, now let's study this stuff. And usually, because they've been floundering in the deep end of the pool, they go like, oh, I know what holding my breath is because he just made me do that. So it helps that way.
That's a really good philosophy. And I appreciate learning like that too. I'm sure it's very effective. And specifically the kind of field you're working within, which I'd like to bring up. There's a trend of tech schools emerging, video game schools or design or art or computer graphics schools. What do you think the future of these kinds of programs is, and what can they offer to the public?
You know, that's that question that can't be answered, except to say that we're continuing to go down that path. That's the part that probably won't change, given no planetary disaster. They've stopped making film cameras. Sony stopped making them. There was a big announcement. Panasonic, Aeroflex. They stopped making cameras that shoot film. They all are shooting strictly digital now. So that's the new era. It's going to be digital. And that shouldn't be any surprise to young people because they've only lived in a digital era. But to know what it's actually going to be 10 years from now, your guess is as good as mine. We don't have a clue because we don't know that 10 years ago, all of us would be walking around texting on a smartphone, taking pictures of little movies. YouTube would be an explosion that it is. You know, all of that is like incredibly new. It's going to be new again. We just don't know what it's going to be.
But you're still working at finding the boundaries of that, I guess.
I think the key is to know where we are today versus where we were 10 years or 20 years ago. Work that and then be prepared to, on a daily basis, sort of, change it as it happens. The more that there's digital photography, the more there's digital insert, the more people like James Cameron keep coming up with new technologies, the more we at the institutional level have to observe it, understand it, and embrace it so that we take it to the students, go, here's a little piece of technology. More importantly is if a student is brought along effectively and understands today's latest technologies and the skills that are behind it, meaning the drawing visual skills, then their ability to step over to the next technology when it happens is much easier than if they don't have to go back to zero each time.
Broadview is hosting a reception in an annual student art show on June 4th with a grand opening scheduled for July. What do you like about those sorts of events and what can we look forward to?
Well, what I like about it is the students coming and seeing their work when it's actually presented in a formal situation. Big smiles on their faces. They don't expect to see their work that way sometimes. And so it's the lights come on. It's really great, great fun. Also, I'm impressed with the work when I see it up and displayed in a formal setting as well. So the students are really talented. And I think that's the part of the joy that I get out of it.
Were you surprised when you came here to Utah at the amount of talent that you saw?
Absolutely. I mean, absolutely. When they said we were going to go to Salt Lake City to open the school, there were particular reasons for it business-wise that made a lot of sense. There were the Utah career colleges that were here that were purchased, and we took one of them and made them into the BFA program magnet school. But when I got here, first thing I noticed was tattoo parlors all over the place. When I'm driving down the street, I could find a copy of The Village Voice almost right away. And I said, this is a strange town. You know, I really thought it was going to be LDS and the specter of the spire and all of that. And it turns out that there's this underground like Slug. And we started to feed off of that. And I think that was the most surprising and absolutely re-energizing aspect to Salt Lake City. All the people that I find that come here for the first time, you know, are just like bitten by it. They just don't understand. They don't expect it to be here. And it's just blossoming here. And I think that's the greatest thing about it. I'm enjoying. I don't think about Santa Monica that much.
Well, that makes one of us. It's a beautiful place. I still live there. But I'm glad you're here. Utah is glad you're here. We certainly appreciate your talents helping out local students because we've got a burgeoning art and film community, as you mentioned. So thank you, and thank you for your time today.
It's been my pleasure.
For more information on the college and courses, visit Broadview University at broadviewuniversity.edu. I Am the Ocean is a five-piece post-hardcore band from Salt Lake City. They formed in 2006 and released a debut album, And Your City Needs Swallowing, on Uprising Records in 2007. They returned in October of 2009 with their sophomore album, Escape is Fiction. And in 2011, the band joined semi-local label Sound vs. Silence, releasing their brand new EP, Overhead. From that EP, here's Seasons of Decay from I Am the Ocean. That was Seasons of Decay from I Am the Ocean, from their brand new EP, which comes out June 5th on SVS and iTunes. For more info on the band, search for I Am the Ocean on Facebook. And to purchase the physical album, visit soundversussilence.com. Audrey Newhouse is a painter from Salt Lake City. She started painting back in 2009 with no formal training. Instead, she took inspiration by observing different forms and from videos. Newhouse returned to Utah in October after a brief stint with art in London. Slug writer Amanda Nuri interviewed Newhouse about her chosen career.
So tell me about what first cultivated your interest in making art.
It was something I always did, like even when I was really little, like 2 years old, I was always drawing on stuff. It's been just that one talent that my parents have always said really good at and really focused on. Like I always did really well, like in my art classes and things like that. And it's just something that, I don't know, it just comes as a second nature to me. I don't know, I just started doing it when I was younger and then just kept doing it as I got older, doing it every single day. So it's like a part of my life, you know, always has and probably always will be. So it's the one of the only things I'm good at, so, and getting better all the time. I'm always trying to improve what I'm doing.
So have you studied art formally? I mean, how do you get your education?
I've never studied art formally. I've never gone to college for it or anything like that. I'm planning on doing it, but I really study a lot of different artists, like artists that I like a lot. I study their technique, watch a lot of videos and just study how they do it as well, and then I'll take different bits of that and kind of make it my own. So I get really inspired by other artists, and it's kind of what gives me my drive to try harder and get better.
Have you always lived and worked in Salt Lake City?
No, I haven't actually. I just moved back from England in October, and I was doing art out there for a living. I worked in a couple different galleries, and then I decided to come back. For the last 5 years, that's what I was doing out there.
I know, I've read that you did a show out there. You curated a show, actually, Nightmares and Fairy Tales?
Yep, I did two, actually. There was Nightmares and Fairy Tales was the second one. We just did a group show in the gallery I worked at. It was the first one I ever did. And it was me and another guy.
What was that experience like in the UK?
It was good. It was interesting because, I mean, it's a different country. Like, living in a different country and working in a different country is so much different than visiting a different country. But I found that my art did really well out there. It moved really fast. I mean, I got a lot of opportunities in a very short amount of time, so it just became my full-time job.
How did that experience compare to the experience you've had here in Salt Lake?
It's been so long since I've been back in Salt Lake, probably about over 5 years. When I did live out here before, my art did do pretty good. I mean, I sold a few pieces here and there, but I don't think I quite took it as seriously as I do now. Like, it was just something I did for fun, but now I'm kind of thinking more on terms of something I want to do professionally. It's something I could do every day, like all day. Mm-hmm. And I think I've decided to make it more a part of my life now than before.
Can you kind of describe your process for making art and maybe describe your art a little too?
Yeah, my art's been described as quite a few different things. I guess the real term for it is like pop surrealism or lowbrow art. I've had people call it like creepy cute before, because there is kind of a creepy factor, but it's still got the cute factor as well. I usually will start out sketching, you know, maybe look at other artist stuff to get inspiration, or, you know, a lot of like visual inspiration. I'm a visual worker, so I have like a bunch of like image libraries on the internet where I'll scroll through images of things that might maybe spark something creative in my mind. And then I'll just work with that and then start sketching and then come up with ideas that way, and then when I finally got something that I want, then I will transfer it onto a canvas and just start painting.
I've looked at a few of your pieces, and they seem to be they're almost caricature-ish, a little bit, with like exaggerated eyes, seductive expressions, real heavy makeup, and they're primarily women. Mm-hmm. Can you explain like these elements of your work?
I mostly draw women just because I can't, like I've tried drawing guys before, and it just doesn't seem to have the same effect. Plus, they always end up looking like girls anyway.
Okay.
So yeah, I just primarily draw girls.
When I was looking at it, I kept thinking that I could see it as a tattoo. Have you ever considered tattoo?
Actually, yeah. I actually did that in the UK just to make extra money on the side here and there. I designed a few tattoos for people. I went in with one of the guys while he was getting it done and just watched him get my art tattooed on his arm.
Wow.
And it was like the coolest thing ever. I was like, this is so awesome.
Yeah.
Like, totally. That's gonna be there forever.
So, did you have any specific artists that you were influenced by? I was thinking I could almost see like some influence of like Frida Kahlo or surrealists.
I love stuff like that, a lot of like older paintings. Like I went to the Louvre once when I was in Paris and was just absolutely amazed by it. Like just some of those paintings are so huge and just so beautiful. I like a lot of modern artists too, like Mark Rydin and Camila Rose Garcia. Like her use of colors is just amazing.
And you use very bright colors in your work.
I really, really like bright colors. I used to use a lot of dark colors, but now
What made the change?
I don't know. I think maybe I changed a bit, so my work got brighter.
It's understandable.
Yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about the work that's going to be featured at Whole Foods?
There's a few different things I'm playing with right now. There's a couple of different, like, new things I'm trying. There's going to be a few, like, hanging sculptures as well. I think the stuff I'm doing now has sort of got, like, a carnival thing to it. Mm-hmm. Or, like, a sideshow carnival thing to it, so I think it'll be good.
Have you actually made that work yet? Or are you currently working on it?
Currently working on it, but I've got most of it like already sketched out, like all the ideas and stuff. I just need to paint them now. So,
how many pieces do you think there will be?
I'm not sure exactly. I'm not even sure how many I'm allowed to have in there, but I think that's something I'll sort of figure out like later on when it comes closer to the time. But I'll just make as many as I can in that amount of time.
And do you work pretty quickly?
Most of the time I do. It depends on what it is, really. Sometimes if I'm doing bigger paintings with a lot of detail in it, it'll take a while. Mm-hmm. Like one of my more popular paintings is the Alice in Wonderland one, and it's pretty big, and there's just tons of detail in it. Mm-hmm. And that took me like probably 2 weeks of like painting every day.
So there was another show that I had read a little bit about called Animalistic you did.
Oh yeah.
Was that the second one that you did in UK or?
That was second or the third.
Okay, so that was also second or the third. In the UK.
Yeah.
That was seemed like a really interesting show. Like there were a lot of, I guess it was kind of
animal
looking
elements.
At the primal instincts.
Those are some of my favorite paintings, actually. Like the girl with the cat paws and the butterflies. Like I love that one. And the girl with the bear paws. I like doing little themes like that and like incorporating different things like that into like human nature. Mm-hmm. And I thought Animalistic was a good one.
I thought it was like a pretty cool show.
Yeah,
for sure.
That was one of my favorites.
New House will be on display at Whole Foods in Trolley Square from June 1st through the 30th. And to see her artwork, check out her online gallery at audreynewhouse.carbonmade.com.
Do 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 do. I messed that one up a little bit.
That's great. We're just gonna loop that. That's gonna be the music.
Yeah, that's kind of how it already is.
The soothing sounds of Ricky Vigil. Thank you, Ricky, for joining me for events today.
I am glad to be here, JP.
As usual, bringing something interesting and unique with your take on the theme song. And your take on events.
Yeah, I'm glad to help.
I'm glad you're excited because it's a pretty exciting week we've got here. We're going to start things off on Tuesday, May 29th with Dr. Sketchies at Metro Bar.
Yeah, I actually went to the last Dr. Sketchies. It's a lot of fun. So it's the anti-art school. You basically go there and you get to drink and you get to do a bunch of figure drawing with some lovely ladies as your models. And at the end of the night, you can enter a little competition. You can win cool free stuff. So if you like drawing, I highly recommend it.
And you definitely would like this theme, the Out of Hell Demon theme.
Yeah.
Metal guy, right?
Yeah, I mean, hell's fine.
You're wearing a shirt full of skulls, Ricky.
These are like monkey skulls. They're friendly.
Whatever. Oh, right, of course. It says Los...
Samba de los Muertos. It's actually inspired by a video game called Samba de Amigo. Anyway, that's not what we're here
to do. No, this makes for great radio. People love that they can't see your shirt. It's theater of the mind, Ricky.
Yeah.
All right, moving on. Thursday, May 31st, it's the annual Salt Lake Comedy Festival at Broadway Theater. And I believe that is hosted and organized by Richie Stedman of Radio from Hell fame. You know Radio from Hell.
Yeah, I listen often, and Richie is very instrumental not only in that show, but he does a lot of other cool stuff in Salt Lake. But this event runs through June 2nd. They have improv, they have stand-up, they have a day of workshops, basically, if you like comedy in Salt Lake, if you like local comedy, this is a rad event.
And do you want to tell us about Friday?
Yeah, Friday, June 1st is when the new issue of Slug Magazine comes out.
Where can I pick that up?
You can pick that up any place cool. Where's your favorite place to pick up Slug?
Probably one of those street vendors in front of Capitol Theater.
Yeah.
On 200 South. You know where that is.
Yeah.
We've got receptacles where you can pick up the magazine all over downtown. It's great.
Yeah, and beyond.
You can also get it online, of course.
Slugmag.com.
And that's also the day the Pride Festival starts. It runs until Sunday, June 3rd. We always have a great time at Washington Square Park. And also the rooftop concert series in Provo happens that day. It's The Moth in the Flame and Desert Noises. You can find out more info online.
And we have an article about the rooftop concert series in our June issue. So you can pick up an issue, read about it, read it on your way to Provo, and then check out the show.
Who Likes Short Shorts is a film festival. Not just a great phrase. That happens at the Post Theater, featuring films 8 from 10:30 p.m. I love short films. I'm sure you love short films.
Yeah, they're cool. I have a short attention span, so short films are really my bread and butter.
And Saturday, June 2nd, we all know Esther, our resident cyclist on staff, is going to be at this event.
Yeah, it's the Bike Prom, which is at the Grand Hall in the Pacific Union Building at the Gateway. And you can see all kinds of fancy cyclists making their way down to the Gateway, I'm sure. It should be a fun event.
Another fun event taking place on that day that's outdoor related is the Dirty Dash at Soldier Hollow in Midway, Utah. It's a mud run, and you can register at thedirtydash.com. People
yeah.
love getting dirty while they're running. I don't know what that's about. I hate running, but some people really into it. Ricky, did you know that?
Yeah, I did know that people enjoyed running. I was aware.
Fair enough. Fair enough. And Sunday, June 3rd, it's the Pride Parade. It's attached to the Pride Festival, the aforementioned Pride Festival.
Yeah, and Slug Magazine has a float in the Pride Parade. If you read Princess Kennedy's column in our May issue, you know that our theme is super queeros. So we'll be running down the street in our fanciest superhero gear, spreading the joy of Pride, as we do every year.
Do you know what you're going to dress up as?
A superhero.
Great answer, Ricky.
Thanks.
I am going to be wearing a cape of some sort. I don't know what. It's probably going to be, you know, chartreuse color.
I think you should only wear a cape.
God, I don't know if my body will be ready. Pride ready.
Yeah.
I gotta start doing some crunches.
Yeah.
For more information about the daily calendar, you can check it out in the back of our magazine or at slugmag.com. We also have an iPhone app. I know you're way into technology. You've got one of these iPhones, right, Ricky?
No, I don't. I
what?
Don't have a smartphone. I apologize, JP.
Oh my God. I don't have an iPhone either. But people tell me it's grand. It's a great app.
Yeah, that's what I hear.
You can also listen to our episode. You can call us from there. You can read past issues in addition to checking out the daily calendar. Thank you for joining me today, Ricky.
Hey, no problem.
We're going to play your outro music right now. It'll sound great.
Okay.
Doesn't that sound great?
Yeah, that sounds awesome.
Here come the Wasatch Roller Derby. Here come the Wasatch Roller Derby. Rotten Musicians is a rap group made up of members Mark Dago from The Numbs and Daniel Fisher, as well as DJ Shanty. They're best known for their single Plus 20 Broadsword and the theme for the Wasatch Roller Derby League. In June 2011, the group released their EP, the appropriately titled EP. That's E-P-E-E. This April, the band released the single in tribute to the late PBS painter Bob Ross, sampling the theme song from The Joy of Painting for the background beat. Here's I Miss Bob Ross from Rotten Musicians.
Hi, welcome back. I miss Bob so badly. Every show had me glued to the screen as a scene appears magically. Yeah, I sat too close to catch the host who packs the most in the half hour, then ghosts. Scooter on toast and a light beer. Maybe a little rhyme lives right here. I like making words swirl around my little world of sound where nobody wears a crown. You know, particular, a love letter fantastic. A ride of color that shaped right into language. A fairy tale, heartfelt, relive the enchantment. Rescued by the wonder, devoted to the magic. Magnum opus, open philosopher Stonehenge. Shogun slice, precise, masterful Ronin. A place, a purpose, a promise that's never broken. In the sacred art of turning dreams right in the open. Cloud.
whisper. But just
play with that, building you a masterpiece ambition. Innovate incredible,
innocent
arisen. Make a difference even with the signature mix I'm written. Reminding me of what I'm supposed to be and what I've been missing.
A little bit of Van Dyke brown and cadmium yellow. Make the canvas say hello like we're in a bordello. But baby, baby, be mellow. No need to accelerate celebrations.
There we go.
So if your brush stroke goes a bit counterfeit, beat the devil out of it, where the wild owl live. Moving on a mountain, a lazy lay where the fallow is. Happy accidents, actually where all the action is.
A fable with identity galore in each molecule. A triumph for what I felt in a 30-minute module. Imagination alive through the canvas of college rule. The how-to of each and every brush stroke to follow you.
God bless.
That was a Rotten Musicians tribute to the man himself, entitled I Miss Bob Ross. To download the track for free, as well as the rest of the group's discography, visit them at rottenmusicians.bandcamp.com. And for more info on the group themselves, check out facebook.com/rottenmusicians. The Lost Media Archive is a collection of film and video oddities, home to Mondo, kitsch, cult, ephemeral, experimental, historical, obsolete, forgotten, and unearthed audiovisual and textual documents. Once a month, the Archive hijacks a screen at Broovies for a full movie, for an event dubbed the Incredibly Strange Movie Night. Slug writer Cody Kirkland chatted with LMA founder and curator Blair Sterrett.
Tell us when, where, and why you started this collection.
I think my collecting started in high school, mainly with music, and I just wanted to find what else was out there that wasn't talked about in your local music store. I had never heard things like the Dr. Demento show, but people had talked about it. So I wanted to do something like that, even though I'd never actually heard it. I was collecting unusual music from thrift stores, from anywhere I could get my hands on it, and I was making compilations for friends. And that expanded, my unusual taste in music expanded into film with my interest in just what showed up on television at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. And it just expanded from there, and I just started showing these things to friends, and also living in Japan as a child, I was just exposed to a lot of really strange things, especially I think in fifth grade I was introduced to the hopping vampire genre that comes out of China, and it just blew my mind, and found these artifacts both in, you know, audio and in visual formats to be kind of, you know, cultural artifacts, because people don't talk about them, but I still feel they are a big part of our culture, and I felt that it's a shame that a lot of these things go unnoticed and neglected, and I just started to have this sense of duty to save and preserve and talk about and share these things with people.
What are some of your prized pieces in the collection, some of your favorite stuff?
I just the other day, going through my VHS tapes, I actually found my video cassette that I made in fifth grade of the film Mr. Vampire, which is the definitive Chinese hopping vampire movie. And that's one of the films that just really changed my life, just because it was so bizarre and it was so outside the Western view of things and culture and correctness. Finding that cassette tape and seeing how I had tried to mimic Chinese characters on the side that I didn't understand, and I even drew pictures on the sticker of some of the characters. Even though I now have this on DVD, I still treasure that cassette tape. My my discovery of the Troll 2 VHS tape, obviously it's made a huge impact on my life. It's spurned the whole discovering that it was filmed here in Utah, and then finding all the actors, and then holding the world's first cast reunion in Provo. And that it just exploded from there. I knew once I saw that film, all it would take was just lighting a match and it would just start a huge flame, you know?
Yeah. Media Archive is the host of the Incredibly Strange Movie Night, a monthly screening of obscure films. Give us some background on this event.
The Incredibly Strange Movie Night itself started when I was an animation student in Provo at BYU. We were just talking during a class as animators, just our love for low-budget movies and, you know, the old horror and sci-fi and the really campy films. And so we decided to get together and hold something, I think we called it Bad Movie Night in the beginning. But after a few months, I decided to change that name because being in Provo and surrounded by a lot of religious people, they thought we were showing porn or something. That's their definition of bad, you know? And I thought it was a little degrading to these films with that title, just because something is low budget and, you know, and campy, I don't necessarily think it's bad. So I actually find most of these films very enjoyable, very entertaining. I think a bad movie is something that's boring and unwatchable.
Yeah. These are definitely watchable.
Yeah.
So the Incredibly Strange Movie Night started as a small get-together and now presents a monthly screening at Broovies in Salt Lake. How has the reception been at Broovies?
It's been good. It's been mixed, too. I've been trying to show films that I feel are better suited for a bigger screen, for a larger audience. Some do better than others. I think sometimes I don't prepare an audience well enough ahead of time for what they're in for. It's just happened a couple of times. Like when I showed Russia's first horror movie. It's the first horror movie they ever made because, you know, their government, they weren't allowed to do such things. When we as Americans think of horror, we have a completely different vision of what that means. And when I showed this film, people didn't understand that it was more like a gothic fairy tale, you know? There's no, like, gore, and there's some monsters and things, but it's not like what people expected.
What was that called?
It's called V. It's V-I-Y. A lot of people pronounce it Vi in the States. It's actually really, really famous in Russia, but very few people have seen it here. I have really strange criteria for the films that I show at Incredibly Strange Movie Night. These are films that I don't feel that people would go and look for on their own, or people would go out and rent on their own. And they have to be films that are kind of unheard of for the most part to most people. I don't show, you'll never see me showing a movie like Goonies or The Big Lebowski or The Blade Runner maybe. But I don't show those types of films because I feel like you can see those anywhere and at any time. And I actually don't own a lot of movies. Like, I don't own the Lord of the Rings movies. I don't think I own most of the Star Wars movies. Things like that, just because I feel like I can go borrow those from somebody next door, you know, because everybody has them. And so I feel like the goal of Incredibly Strange Movie Night is to expose people to this hidden culture that has fallen through the cracks or just doesn't get much coverage by the mainstream media and critics and things. In a way, I feel like we are creating the new cult films.
Kind of an underground DIY anthropologist, or archaeologist almost.
Yeah, and that's what I think of us now. Over the years, we've just become media archaeologists. And It's also, you know, it's also anthropology, because it is a study of human nature and our history as well. But it's a lot of digging, a lot of thrift stores, a lot of liquidation sales, a lot of just finding what's out there that hasn't been reissued on DVD or won't be reissued in any other format. And I feel that our culture just has this tendency to just throw things away once a new technology comes out. Everything from our past goes straight to the garbage. And so that's why, you know, through the years I've been collecting old 16 millimeter films, old film strips from libraries. I've gone around to a lot of libraries talking to librarians about formats that they're going to throw away, and it saddens me that I missed the big dumping of 16 millimeter. I missed it by 2 years.
Oh man.
So I have some, but most of what I've gotten from school libraries are film strips.
Incredibly Strange Movie Night takes place at Broovies this Tuesday, May 29th. This month, the films being featured include 1983's Fire and Ice, 1985's Gwen, The Book of Sand, all five parts of 1989's Hell's Bells, and this month's feature at Broovies, the 1984 film Voyage of the Rock Aliens. To learn more about the LMA and future movie nights, visit them online at lostmediaarchive.tumblr.com. Thanks for listening to Soundwaves from the Underground. For all things Slug Magazine, visit slugmag.com. Are you a vegan and have a favorite place to eat at? Is there a particular vegan item on someone's menu that you're just dying to have or try? Send an email to soundwaves@slugmag.com or call and leave us a message on our automated voicemail line at 858-233-9324. That's available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. We may just play you on the show. This podcast was created by Slug Magazine and is produced by Gavin Sheehan, with associate producers Jeanette D. Moses, Ricky Vigil, Esther Moronio, and Jonathan Paxton. Our executive producer is Angela H. Brown. Our theme was performed by Birthquake and recorded by Jesse Ellis, with our main logo and art design by T. Doan and technical design by Kate O'Connor. On next week's episode, we're going to be checking in with Heavy Metal Shop after 25 years of bringing brutality to Salt Lake. We'll also be finding out about the Of Meat and Marrow dance performance at SB Dance, and the Urban Arts Festival at the SLC Arts Hub. Until then,